सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
After me. We're on page 10, right? Mumukshut Twam Kim. Okay. Mumukshut Twam Kim.
Mumukshut Twam Kim.
Kim. Neuter Kim. What is Mumukshut Twam? Remember that Twam affix or the Ta affix gives the abstract, the ness. What is the state of being? Okay. For being a Mumukshu, Mumukshu is a Mumukshu, someone who desires liberation. Mumukshu Twam is that state of being a mumukshu. So, state of being a person who desires liberation. So, mumukshu Twam Kim. Then, so, what is it? Moksho me bhuyat. Repeat.
Moksho me bhuyat.
Iti icha.
Iti icha.
Sandhi, mokshaha. So a lot of times that visarga changes to O. It's on the previous side of the visarga if there's a short A. A plus visarga, followed by a soft consonant or a vowel, goes to O. Followed by a soft consonant or A. So I have to remember my rules. Short A, followed by visarga, then followed by a soft consonant or the letter A, will go to O. If it's the letter A, so say if you have an A followed by the visarga, those two dots. A plus the visarga, followed by the visarga, or an H with a dot under it. So at the letter short A, followed by a visarga, followed by the letter A, then that visarga goes to O, but the letter A goes to that S. It's called avagraha. So you see an O plus an S, avagraha. That stands for a silent A. Right? So sometimes you'll see... you know what that is in transliteration. Anyway, never mind, you're going to learn this. I'm just throwing these little tidbits out. Okay. Once you learn Sanskrit, you'll understand all this. I'm just giving you the samskaras. Okay. So, mokshaha me bhuyat iti icha. Remember, the word iti, you can think of it as putting something... Let's say there's a statement that ends with iti, or even the statement can begin with iti and go to the end of the clause or the end of the statement. And it will put it in quotes, or it can put, you can translate it in an indirect, in an indirect statement. But here, just literally it says, moksha, liberation, me, for me, bhuyat, a potential, let there be liberation for me. Let me be liberated. May I be liberated. It's potential, but potential and the imperative case are often used synonymously. They have different meanings, but they also are used in the same way. And it's kind of a prayer. Potential is kind of a strong prayer. Yeah? Please, Bhagavan, you know, let me be free. And in the West it would go, free me or relieve me from this suffering, or if you're really there, please help me, you know, please help me. Because in the West, we don't have so much knowledge. Now it's becoming a more global world. And so you can know just by the way that there is such a thing as liberation. It's talked about in the East and it's really infiltrated. The concept has liberated, has trickled over into the West. So you know that such a thing exists, you know, and that there is such a thing as freedom from suffering. There is such a thing as a self that is really not subject to birth and death. So these ideas have come over. But even before they've come over, you wonder, and your prayer can be to Bhagavan, if you're there, this is like a typical Western prayer. Bhagavan, if you're there, please help me, please save me. In whatever form that takes. For somebody who's within the Vedic culture, who's familiar just on just a cultural level, they know that there's such a thing as moksha. They know that there's such a thing as Brahman. They know that the self is supposed to be Brahman, that there's such a thing as Ishvara, you know, and so they know how to, what they're supposed to ask for, that there is such a thing as liberation and that this self is supposed to be free and infinite. These things, all these words are there, but without understanding. And so now I want to know what all of this means. Now, so that's the kind of the prayer in one form or another of the mumukshu. Now, what makes a mumukshu a mumukshu is not just having that idea as a passing fancy, but it becomes my reality. In other words, when I make that prayer, I'm not kidding at all. It's not just a passing idea, or wouldn't that be interesting to know who Brahman is? Wouldn't that be? I wonder what they're saying about liberation. What do they mean by that? But as far as in terms of my being and my heart and who I am, I have plenty of things to do, and I need this to be happy, and I need to accomplish this, and these things need to be accomplished, you know, so that I can be a success in life, so that I can be full and complete. All of these things, really, in my mind, they really are what I need to be a full and complete person. For jnani, all of these, the prarabdha karma is there, right? And so you naturally fit into your prarabdha karma as it unfolds. And for the most part, you're very settled with it. There's not really any real pushback. The problem for us, even in a sense, even an ajnani, as I'm sorry, it's not so much there's a pushback in reference to the unfoldment of the karma, which there can be that also, but usually the unfoldment of your karma is already there. It's already happening, and I'm really unhappy. So whatever is here as your karma, the situation that you find yourself in, is never good enough because I'm looking to it for my fullness, my wholeness, my happiness, and it doesn't have it. It's like in the West we say, you know, you can't get blood from a stone. Not any fault on the part of the stone. It's that that's not its... It doesn't have that to give, you know. And so like that, the creation doesn't have that ananda or that wholeness to give. It's not an object that you seek. We seek the object hoping that it's stuffed with that ananda and then can give it to me because I have the object. I say, that will make me happy. And so I want it, I get it, and then we have our 15-second, you know, samadhi, 15-second of being free from desire, which establishes for me that, yes, the fulfillment of an object, the gaining of the answering of my desire actually makes me happy. This time it didn't last for very long, but that's because I need this. Or that didn't last very long because this person came in and took it away from me. You know, there's always a rationalization as to why the ananda that I receive, that I do gain from the fulfillment of a desire, which is really caused by a shantavritti. You know, you fulfill a desire for the moment you become desireless. So I have that momentary happiness until the next thought comes, really. The next desire comes, or the next fear comes. You know, fear is also a form of desire. Please don't let anybody take this away from me, or please keep this away from me. It's like a negative desire. You know? So as a mumukshu, I don't necessarily realize at all that why I get to experience ananda in the first place is because of shantavritti. That's a big, huge understanding. That it's because of the state of mind is not in competition in any way with my being, and so it as though mimics the ananda that is my own self. It is in a condition that reflects, you know, that is, I say, it resonates so much with myself. These are wonderful understandings. There's so much freedom in these understandings. But when I become a mumukshu, it's not so much at all this understanding of the relationship of Ashantavritti, reflecting my own being every time I fulfill a desire. It's that any desire that I fulfill, the results of it is time-bound. And what makes me a mumukshu is I recognize there's not one thing I can do about it, and the whole universe is trapped in that reality. So it's not like, well, of course, in reference to these things, that's true, but let me try over here. There comes a time when there is no over here. And that's because you recognize the limited nature of everything that exists in the creation, including your body, your mind, your sense organs, you know, every vritti you have, every emotion you have, the whole positive spectrum of emotions. You realize that they're temporal nature. Have you ever had an emotion which lasts forever? Here it is. I'm having this emotion and now it will stay forever. You don't even say that. Because you know that that's the case, but you ignore it. Because there's a lot of implications in that. Oh, this beautiful thought, this beautiful emotion, this beautiful state of being, this is it, this is exactly what I've always wanted. And then it passes, and then you say, how can I get that back? What can I do? You know, please come back. Please. I remember when I was about, 16 or 17, 18 maybe, having that beautiful, just perfect, this is who I am. This is how I am always supposed to be. It wasn't some big bliss thing or anything. It was just me. This is how I am. This is how I'm supposed to be. And then there was this little prayer, please don't take this away. Please don't take it away. As it started to go. No, please don't take it away. Please don't take it away. And I just watched it, you know, moving away. Watch it moving. Nothing I could do to get it back. I felt a lot of sorrow at that one. A lot of sorrow. You know. But that's the reality. If we are even dependent as a jnani, if you are dependent on Ashantavritti, that's a problem. Do you think that you gain knowledge and then the only thing available in your mind, all the other types of vrittis that exist within the whole group of vrittis that are possible are only Ashantavrittis? And from now on, I will only have Ashantavritti. Yeah. Yeah. That isn't true. There are some things true about it, which I'll get into, but that basically is not true. No. You can have the whole gamut of emotions, but the way that you hold them is a little different. That's all. And the shanti of your own being, you know, is what pervades whatever the vritti is there. But we'll get into all of that detail. So the mumukshu, though, is the one who has recognized the temporal nature of all experience. And when that, you recognize that, really, in your gut, where you really understand that, then it is a fact that even though you can fulfill your desires and gain some happiness, that happiness is time-bound, you know? And so that's a realization. There's a viveka there. In that is a viveka. It's one half of the puzzle. That viveka is there. The next viveka, I would say, that is there is not of yourself until you get saint knowledge, but the repercussions of that understanding. One is that isn't what I want. I don't want to be the drowning man in the ocean. I want to be on the shore. I want to be able to say, all is well with me. And I've had that best cup of coffee, as Swamiji says. I know what that is. And that's who I'm supposed to be. And I want that. And I don't want it to come and go. I don't want to be pulled down underneath the water again. So that is a realization that comes from that viveka. And all of that together, that's kind of the fullness of that side of the viveka, leads to vairagya. And the vairagya is that feeling that this is not what I want. It's not that I'm against you know, being successful in my work and getting the things that I need and all of that. But it's not giving me what I really need. It doesn't solve, you know, the ultimate problem, you know. And so with that being my reality, where I actually have assimilated that as a fact that I can do nothing about, you know, it's not like I can change it. It's not like it's my fault. Like, okay, if I could just change a little bit, the world won't be temporal. No. There's no escape from the situation. But I also have a sense that there should be something. Because I have experienced that momentarily. I've had moments of it, and that experience is very, very real of my own well-being, of my own wholeness. It is real. I know it is there. I want that. And so I become a mumukshu because I want that. I want that wholeness. I want to be free. It even goes this far, and we can even understand this on a relative plane. Let me be whole and complete, you know, deal with the ups and downs of the world. I'm not asking, I'm not mental, asking that the world change and become just like Swarga Loka. No. I am ready to be with the ups and downs of the world and the difficult, the good things and the difficult things that that come my way. But let me be one who is whole and complete as I deal with those things. So it's not even about asking the world to change or to be in a different way. It's asking that I be free of that roller coaster ride, you know, that the Maya, the samsara gives. To whatever degree, anything on any level, that includes this world, my body, my mind, my sense organs, the vrittis, my emotions, whatever this world has to give, to whatever degree I'm dependent on that for my ananda, right? To that degree, I'm a samsari. My well-being is dependent upon these things all being a particular way. And go to the most subtle level, everything's fine, but I want this for my mind. I want my mind to always be happy. How about I am always happy? The nature of myself, my being, is always whole and complete, you know? And so let my mind have that as its adhishtana. We'll see it as its base. Then you can be like Swamiji and says, this, all kinds of funny thoughts pass through. Who cares? Why can't that thought pass through? Why is that feeling not allowed to pass through? You know? It's like taking a walk, you know, taking a walk into nature, and all of a sudden there's a pile of junk there. And you get all upset, you know, because the pile of junk is there. No. Pick it up. There's no reason to get upset. Help, you know. You have a funny vritti coming through. It needs some attention. Give it the attention. It's simple. Yourself is there blessing that. That's the beauty of it. So this mumukshutvam is something that becomes central to you and your mind whirls around it, you know. I remember when I was young and this, I really wanted to meet a guru, my teacher. I wanted it so badly. And because I had been exposed to yoga and some books and, you know, the Lao Tzu and also the Upanishads, these little paperbacks. And I really wanted that so badly. And then I read that autobiography of a yogi. Mm-hmm. And it was really depressing. It depressed me so much because... Because to be someone who is deserving of that knowledge, you had to be a very special being, like they were like almost made of air and almost walking on, I don't know if you remember, they were so subtle all through and through, you know, made of air, almost walking on air as they tread along. So very, very pure and ethereal, you know. And then Babaji, the teacher, in this part of the text, was their teacher, and he would teach them, except for one poor person who wasn't quite subtle enough. And so when he went to Babaji, this is my, how's he remember the story? It's really awful. Because I was like that guy. I wasn't like any of the others. So he came to Babaji, and Babaji said he wasn't pure enough. He would have to take another birth. So you know what he did? He jumped off the cliff. And then I realized, wow, if this is true, we're finished. We have to take other births. So I've told some of you this story, but it's really so sad, it's so silly. But so when I got to India and I met Swamiji, and I knew beyond any doubt that he was my teacher, I had no doubt, and my whole heart was with him only, and I only wanted this knowledge. And so when I was in Rishikesh, I made it to Rishikesh, and I had a private audience with him. I was sitting in this little kutir, and I had this very big thing to say to him. I said, Swamiji, if it's necessary, I will jump off the cliff. He goes, what? I don't remember anything after that. He laughed. He said something like, that won't be necessary. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Because that book kind of had an impression on me. It's hard for me to believe, but then I kind of did, I guess, because I had to say, I will do that. No. Like, where did you... I'm sure I probably told him the Babaji story. I think I did. I don't know if I told him right then. You know? But he never, ever... He didn't laugh at me. Swamiji never did that to me. He never laughed or made fun of anybody. But it shocked him so much. It was such a shock that that would even come to my mind. It was a huge relief, you know. that we can actually be normal people, you know, that you can be a normal person and be a mumukshu and gain this knowledge. You don't have to be some something or other that we are not. Right? Yeah. I know. And so that is such a very grounding understanding, you know. So that was very important to me. And the other important, I'd say, it's not even, we don't even have words for what those things mean to a person. The other thing that happened within that period of time when I was up at Rishikesh, and I'd only known Swamiji for, I don't know, a month maybe? Maybe 2 or 3 weeks. That's how soon it was. Because I met him in Bombay. There were 3 days. Then we went to Ahmedabad for a week or two. Then we went to Rishikesh. We stayed in Rishikesh for a couple of months. So it was just a very short amount of time, short exposure. But my heart was already totally there. One huge realization that I had, that it was like this. These are those, when those light bulbs go off inside, that there is such a thing as a guru. That they're actually in this world, it exists. There is such a thing. That there is Ishwara, there is Bhagawan, there is God. It's real. And that moksha, liberation, actually exists. It is there. And wow, what? I mean, you can hear these things and know these things, but it's another thing to know that they are real, that they are here, that they exist as part of the creation. And when you realize that all of a sudden, that this creation is a benign creation, even though the whole spectrum, from the best to the worst, from the most painful to the most joyous, everything exists here. But if you follow Dharma, Bhagawan will protect you within the Dharma. If you follow a dharma, there's punishment to be had within Maya. Within Maya. That's how it is. But if you want to know yourself, there's no end. This is all Shastra now. I'm adding a little bit to what I said. There is no end to the assistance you will get. There's no end to it. You'll get that assistance and that help from Ishwar, and you will get it from your teachers. You'll get it from the world. Period. You are blessed. We're all blessed to want to have this knowledge. It's very, very sacred. And so that becomes a shraddha that opens up for you. Tremendous shraddha. So the mumukshutvam is not an ordinary thing, you know. But it's very sacred to have it. And it's a promise of the shastra that the mumukshu will be taken care of. You will gain this knowledge, you know. That teacher will come out of the sky. Swamiji says... Swamiji somehow heard of this Timbuktu. You ever heard of it? There's some place in the boonies somewhere in the world called Timbuktu. Right? Even if you're living in Timbuktu, you become a mumukshu, your guru will come there to you. That's no problem. You're taken care of, you'll get what you need. It's a very beautiful understanding to have. So, that mumukshutvam, that, you know, that desire, may I gain this knowledge. I remember when I realized how serious it was for me when I was living in a little apartment, kind of out on the outskirts of Cotati, where the Sonoma State College was. I was taking some classes there. I was getting my BA there. And I had all these wild friends. A lot of the friends were yogis, actually. They were practicing yoga. Yoga did exist back then, you know. So I even took a yoga class at the school. This was in the 60s or so. Late 60s. And so we had a party. And so all of these kids came. There was about 20 people in the party. And everybody brought their Red Mountain wine. If you're not from the States back in those that era, you wouldn't probably know what it is, but it's like the cheapest wine you can ever buy. You know? Say if you would go to a store or go to a liquor store or something. What is the very cheapest wine that you can possibly buy is Red Mountain wine. Mm-hmm. And it comes as a white wine or as a red wine. And so the students would come. Marijuana wasn't that well known then. It wasn't as prevalent as it is now, so people weren't coming with all of their grass and all of that. But they were coming with Red Mountain wine and what's the other thing? I'll try to think of it as some sort of cherry-flavored alcoholic drink. Yeah. And so I remember I was sitting in the floor and all these kids were around. I was also young, 22, I guess. They were all sitting around and they were having a party and having a great time. And I had a bottle of Red Mountain wine. It's not a bottle, it's a gallon. It came in gallons. A gallon of Red Mountain wine there. And so I had my glass of Red Mountain wine. I just thought, I prayed. I said, I don't want, this is not what I want. I remember closing my eyes and kind of imagining myself reaching out to Bhagavan. This is not what I want at all. Please save me. Very serious prayer. Very serious prayer. You know. And then shortly thereafter, I met Swami Chinmayananda. Somebody had brought him to the States, and one school friend called me up and asked if I wanted to go. She had known him for several years, and she asked me. We got a whole carload, like six people crammed into a little car. We went to the city and we went. And when he talked, I was just sitting there listening. There it was. There was the Vedanta. You know, there was the Vedanta. That was the end of it. From there, I just went to every one of his classes. And then he got on a plane to go to Hawaii. So with nothing, I borrowed some money. I got on a plane. I went to Hawaii. And I called my father and mother from Hawaii to ask for money. And my father was so very upset. He was screaming at me to get home right now. You get yourself home right now. And I said, I'm sorry, Dad. I can't come back. I have to go. I have to do this. And I hung up the phone. That was it. And then this Swami went to Hong Kong. I sold my car through friends, and I had a little Volkswagen, and then I went to Hong Kong. And then I never talked to him. I didn't want him to say yes or no. Then I went to, from Hong Kong, he went to Bombay at that time. I went to Bombay, and I remember walking by him on the plane. He was in first class or business class or whatever. He's walking, and he goes, "You?" And I just went, walking. I didn't even ask him. I was way in the back of the plane. I didn't say a word. I just went. Then when I got to, I didn't have a suitcase. I had nothing. Yeah. I didn't even have a passport. I think I had my passport, but I didn't have any kind of visa. Then we needed some kind of visa at that time, which I was able to get, like a 6-week visa or something in Hong Kong. Some, I forget the rigmarole we had to go through. I got that. But when I landed in India, this Swami Chinmayananda, he sent his group of ladies that had come to greet him. There's you, that young girl over there, you go get her and take her to the ashram. And so they came and surrounded me and said, Swamiji wants you to go to the to his ashram with us. You come. I just went, okay. Because I was standing in the middle of this tarmac looking around, thinking, wow, what have I done? Here I am. Okay, here I am. And then these ladies, you know, one of whom is still alive, I still know them. They've most passed away now. Yeah. And then they took me to the ashram. They gave me their saris. Each one gave me saris and these slips and these tops and, you know, dressed me up, you know, and gave me extras. I had really long hair. They braided my hair. They put tilak on, you know, on me. And now it's perfect. In Hong Kong, gave me this name, Radha, some devotee. And so I was introduced then at the ashram to Swami Chinmayananda as Radha. I said, do you like that name, Swamiji? They asked these Indians that were there that gave me, do you like that name, Swamiji? Radha, Radha, Radha. But it was that first night that this Mrs. Bhagat showed me the picture of Swamiji, my Swamiji. And the next day, he came to the ashram. I saw him. I was on the balcony of where the ladies were staying, and I looked down, and this Mrs. Bhagat said, that's him, of this picture, which I still have. That's him. Yeah. And then he was giving a 3-day talk, and they took me to that talk. Now, that is so weird in a way, but it's so perfect, you know. We get, that's the Shastra. That's the promise. And if you all look at your life and how things unfolded in reference to you gaining this knowledge, it is a beautiful, beautiful story. It is magical. Because the creation is magical. It's magical. It's Bhagawan. It's Maya. It's a, you know, it's an amazing, amazing thing. And once that mumukshutvam is there, you've crossed over from samsara to being a mumukshu, and now the Vedanta, the Bhagavad Gita, all of the have guru sisha relationship. That is your world. That's what antakarna shuddhi, upayanishta, upayanisha. That is your world. That's what it is. You live your regular life, but you live it from this vantage point, and there is no turning back. You can't pretend like you don't know that everything is temporal, that there is really no solution here. Please, Bhagawan, save me. Mm-hmm. You can't turn back from a valid knowledge, a valid recognition of your situation here, trapped, because there is no release. But there is a release. There is a release which changes the whole nature of this creation. Everything changes when you realize that there is moksha, that yourself is free from time, is ananda, is everything that you seek, that this universe is just an expression of yourself, of your being, not your mind, but of you, of who you actually are. This universe is an expression of you. There is nothing here that is not your being. You are Ishwar, in fact, because this expression of your being that is Ishwar is an expression of me, of the Atma, of the Self that I am. And so that now you're on this side. You're not no longer really belonging to the Karmakanda, the first part of the Vedas, which is beautiful. The first part of the Vedas, called the Karmakanda, Swamiji will call it, it's a handbook of the handbook for the creation, how to have the most relative happiness I can have in this creation. What are the rules? What is Dharma? How does this all work? How can I be happy here? What can I do? What are the prayers that I should, what is the lifestyle? All of these things, it's all made very, very clear in the first part of the Vedas. What happens to me when I die? All of these kind of questions that deal with the relativity of me in this creation as a jiva. How can I have the most relative happiness? Which really amounts to being a dharmanishtha, where my whole life is a devotion to Bhagavan as Dharma. There's more to say, but that's very all-inclusive in its own way. But even with that, I still want the freedom to be just me. And whatever my condition is, it's good enough for me to become a mumukshu. You're on the other side now. Now, the way you relate to the world is so different. It's really all about knowledge and antakarna shuddhi. And antakarna shuddhi means that the whole expression of my life is an expression of Ishwara, not of the jiva srishti. It's an expression of Ishwara. It's an expression of my being. The Gayatri Mantra, which is passed on to children now, to boys and girls, when they take that Upanayanam, the sacred thread, that mantra is considered to be, maybe perhaps, the most sacred of mantras. You all, I think, I know Swamiji has taught it to you. That mantra is praying that that self-luminous one, which is Brahman, which is Ishwara, that self-luminous one, always guide my thoughts. That all of my thoughts, all of my feelings, you know, the buddhi itself, is always guided by my own being, as opposed to my likes and dislikes, and as opposed to my dark emotions or my hurt emotions, that the expression is always an expression. You can take it like this. The expression of the buddhi is always an expression, a voice of Ishwara, a voice of myself. So that if hurts rise up in the manas, in the mind, hurts rise up, or anger, whatever rises up in the mind, in the manas, that my buddhi is Bhagavan, is an expression of Ishwara, that ananda, that wholeness, that love, who I actually am. My thoughts are based in that, as opposed to be based in some samsara. See what I mean? That when you can imagine these little children chant this for their lifetime from around the age 8, and to the degree that they understand it, the sanctity of this mantra, that because this is exactly what we want, whether we know it or not. You know, let my buddhi be a natural expression of who I actually am. Let my thoughts and my actions be a natural expression of who I am. Let me be myself. And let this upadhi be a natural expression of me. So, we are all mumukshus, jnanis, mumukshu jnanis, jnani mumukshus. Om Tat Sat, beautiful blessing.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namah.